Okay, we can start the discussion session now. So if you could please unshare your screen so that I can spotlight all the speakers of this session. So I have to say before we start that we have a very sharp end to this discussion session, because at, well, at in 40 minutes roughly, there is Renato's talk. It's a colloquium at PI, so the whole PI community will join. And so we have to finish the discussion session a few minutes before the hour. So I'm sorry for whoever I will have to interrupt, but we really have to end the discussion on time. Well, actually a little bit earlier than the hour. So I will spotlight the speakers then. And Philip, if you're here, please turn on your camera.
Philip?
I did.
Okay, great. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So like in the other discussion sessions, I would like to kick off this discussion by asking each of you if you could tell us in 30 seconds if you could frame your research in a broader context and tell us what the most challenging aspects in your field are or the most interesting. So let's go in the speaker's order. So Philip.
Okay, tough question in 30 seconds. So, I mean, there's of course many challenges, but maybe let me focus on something relevant to this conference, so quantizing time. I think one of the things we really need to get away from is this idealized notion of clocks that we see in many talks and in various ways. So, in some of the work that we've been doing in recent years, we've tried to generalize it already to the case where we're not using these PT clocks where the Hamiltonian is just the momentum, but where you also have clock states that are not orthogonal. But that's just one generalization. But in general, of course, if we're interested in gravitational scenarios, we need to be thinking about interacting clocks. And I mean, we've heard something by Mehdi today about it. But we need a lot more work in this, and in particular, in generativity, there exist chaotic or non-integral models, and this actually has a huge impact on the relational dynamics. This is something that we absolutely need to be facing. So we're fooling ourselves by the simplicity of many of the things that we do in the works that we've also discussed today. And of course, going to a field theory context, that's another challenging a step to do, and one of the absolutely necessary ones. So I guess I violated the 30 seconds. I could say more about this, but let me pass it
we
on.
We can leave it for the questions. Lorenzo?
Okay, so frame my research in a more broader context. I would say I'm really interested lately in trying to understand time and all its aspect. There was a very striking sentence by Albert Einstein in which he said that he really understood everything about relativity when he started really asking deep questions about time. So that is somehow the broader sense of what I'm doing for my foundational research right now, understanding time. And about the most interesting challenge, I would say, I partly talked about it in my talk. So I would like to understand what happens if, instead of considering quantum systems more fundamental, one starts to think about quantum events as more fundamental. And, introduce systems as derived notion.
Thank you. Esteban.
Okay, so I am going to sound very much like when I was at the panel of the previous conference, in which I said that I find this research in quantum reference frames or this operational view of time in terms of quantum clocks very promising towards perhaps a new notion of a new way of understanding symmetry and covariance that emerges from taking into account the quantumness of the reference frames that we use to do quantum mechanics. And something that is challenging is, so in my talk, for example, I focus on very specific type of reference frames that are very classical, gigantic, like this regular representation, which are very sharply defined. If one would like to introduce this type of systems and also consider gravity, for example, these systems would gravitate very much, right? So I guess in at the fundamental level, the question of resources goes much beyond whether we have a good clock or a bad clock. And then space-time is what's measured by a good clock and all the rest is simply errors that we can attribute to the badness of the other clock. I think there's something much deeper about considering the issue of resources. How would a small clock define time? Because this is very important once we introduce gravity and see what how this affects the gravitational field and so on.
Great, thanks. Mehdi?
Thank you. So I guess I've already raised this point about the two different approaches. And I guess for me, ideally, I would like to be able to find perhaps a process that happens in nature that can be explained using one of the approaches, but not the other. Because basically it makes me a little bit, I should say, when I'm trying to use quantum clocks, I tried in my talk to give the two different motivations for different approaches. But then at the end of the day, I would like to know which one is the one that is supposed to be used, you know, it's because they give two different formulation of time in quantum mechanics, right? So, yeah.
Thanks. And Rodolfo?
Well, for me, the most interesting problem around this subject is the one of the, what happens with covariance when one consider include the reference frames. That is, there are, as I said, global properties that I expect to preserve, but are also local properties, and they are, I don't know exactly what will happen. I would like to study first some simple systems that apparently may be studied. The cosmological case is obvious. And system media superspace systems also appear to be possible to study, but the main problem and the main idea is that this related with the limitations in the measurement of local quantities like the metric or the external curvature, whatever. When one has quantum reference frames.
Thanks a lot. So we already have a lot of interesting observations from which we can start, but we already have a question from Harvey. So Harvey, if you want to unmute yourself.
Thank you so much. I want to raise an issue that touches on the fascinating talks of Lorenzo, Esteban, and Mehdi. Lorenzo, in your talk, you had a statement along the following lines. Time is defined by what is measured by clocks. So time is defined in terms of clocks. Now, this is a view that goes against a tradition dating back to Newton and defended by Poincaré and more recently by Julian Barber and no doubt others. And according to this view, clocks are constructed, whether they're wristwatches or atomic clocks, in order to act in synchrony, to march in synchrony with the abstract temporal parameter that appearing in the most fundamental equations of motion, in particular for the non-gravitational interactions. This is a point of view that explains the issue of a good clock versus a bad clock, because the better the clock, the more it marches in step with the temporal parameter and the fundamental equations. And that explains why, for example, an atomic clock is better than a wristwatch, which in turn is better than the heartbeat in my heart. Now, I think this view is consistent with the Page-Witter construction in quantum cosmology. And I think it's consistent with the view of the treatment of quantum clocks in Mehdi's talk. Would that be right?
Wants to.
So maybe I should start by saying it's true. In my talk, I did use the definition of time as what is measured by a clock, but I never wanted to say that is what I mean by time. That is one possibility, okay? So there are many, I usually have a slide, but I didn't have time for that. But there are many, many different definitions of time that we use in physics. Mm-hmm. And outside physics, there are even more. This one I used is the one which is useful for this kind of scenario, of course, but there are many different ones. You have the clock time, which is basically what in general relativity is considered as proper time. But of course, you can have coordinate time. You can have... I also talked about time of arrival, which is something entirely different, for example. So this is just to point out that it's true. Time can be defined as what is shown by a clock, but that's not the only possibility. For example, I don't know if Carlo is still here, but if you take his textbook on quantum gravity, there's a whole chapter exactly on this point. He has a table in which he lists all the possible different definitions of time that one can use. And regarding the fact that different clocks will follow this abstract time parameter in different ways, I totally agree. The construction I was giving is highly idealized, in which you have this clock with infinite spectrum, its Hamiltonian is equal to its momentum. I mean, these are highly idealized conditions which you can only achieve approximately in practice. So, and of course, then you run into the issues that, for example, Rodolfo was pointing out.
Anybody else would like to comment?
Yes, I would just like to say that me and Alex were looking at the clock exactly like Harvey mentioned, which is we don't have a time operator. We basically want to measure, we want to keep track of dynamics of the clock, and we want to do it the best way that we can. And we want all the other effects to not be present in the formulation. So we try to optimize everything so that we can just see the effects of quantizing the quantum clock. And the better the clock is, the closer we are to the root of this quantization and what it's doing to the formulation of quantum time, basically.
Thank you.
Yes, I say that. I agree very much with Lorenzo's answer, and I would say in general, a challenging aspect of this research line is something very simple. It's basically how to distinguish features of space-time from those that arise by having a bad clock. I think this is an important challenge that we would have to distinguish if we would like to figure out features about space-time in quantum mechanics by using clocks. What of these features are truly about space-time, and which of them are really traceable back to having an imperfect machine, or whether the question that I've just mentioned makes sense at all or not. Maybe there's no distinction.
Okay.
Thank you.
Czaslaw, you have a question?
Yeah, actually, I would follow this discussion. I would follow up on that. And I think we should have an open eyes here. I mean, I understand that just in line with what Harvey said, also the Page-Wouters approach in this this immediate approach where we have this idealized clock, as Lorenzo said, with well, infinite spectrum, and it was actually chosen such to meet our, as you said, most fundamental descriptions of motion. But maybe one can turn the story upside down and say, well, what if I really think, or if I go this operational way and say, no, the time is what clock shows, and let's be very consequent about that. And so let's see if I choose a different clock, and not only choose, maybe I have no other choices, for example, and I will elaborate today, then via Page-Wouters formalism, I might arrive at some different fundamental quantities or fundamental description, not maybe Schrödinger equation in the way how we have it. And this is just because I define time with respect to another clock. And now why I think we should keep the eyes open, because it could be that in some, I think this is some a common point in many quantum gravity approaches, that you might have, if I may say, something like a finite resource in some region of space-time, let's say. And so maybe I don't have enough resources to even define the clock. The clock in the Schrödinger equation is infinite dimensional. It's a huge resource. So maybe I have a physically motivated restrictions on how much resources I can put into the clock as something which will cover in correlations the rest of the space-time, which I can define as a system. And therefore, I cannot even reach this idealization of Schrödinger equation. But then it's a really fundamental one. It's not the choice of a bad clock in Esteban sense. I could not have a better clock, which is what Rodolfo also is putting in somehow through this answer. It's more, I would be interested in comments. Sorry.
Yeah, maybe can I add something to this? So, I mean, let me just clarify. So the Page-Wouters formalism actually gives a perfectly well-behaved Schrödinger equation also away from these ideal clocks. So it's not true that if you have bounded Hamiltonians that you necessarily end up with something that's non-unitary where you get decoherence. So that's what we've also shown in our papers. So it really just depends on whether the clock degrees of freedom are global or not. So whether they're monotonically running forward or not. And you can have those even for bounded Hamiltonians. It's just that the clock states are not going to be orthogonal, but you still get a nice Schrödinger equation. But things get a little different when you have interactions. And then here, I'm not only referring to the work by Alex and Mehdi, where they get some kind of delocalized modification to the Schrödinger equation, but you know, they still argue that you get something unitary there. And there's something you will in general not have when you have some really bad interactions in your system. So in particular, even in fairly simple cosmological models, this is not going to happen. As, for instance, the closed Friedmann universe with a massive scalar field, that's one where you have a scalar field that is kind of going all over the place. It's highly oscillating. The scale factor is another degree of freedom that's kind of recollapsing, and this model is actually something non-iterable. And so either degree of freedom that you may pick, and you have many different choices, they all go through many different turning points. And so these clocks are definitely not monotonic. And in this case, you will not actually get any kind of unitary relational dynamics. It's just impossible. And so in some sense, you know, I mean, these are of course also kind of relatively simple models. In some of these simple models, you basically have only bad clocks in some sense. And then, of course, in the quantum sphere, you can ask, what do you do with it? But it's something that's, at least I think in generic situations, it's something we kind of have to live with. We have to face up to these challenges and then think about what we actually mean by relational dynamics when we just don't have any good clocks that are, where basically all choices of clocks that we have, you know, are pathological in some sense. And there are some ways in which one can actually approach this. And so for instance, transition amplitudes are still something that might make sense in such scenarios.
Thank you, Philip.
So maybe can I just say a very short comment to answer Czaslaw's question, because there are a few papers by Seth Lloyd around 15 years ago in which he asks exactly the question you were asking. So how limited resources in space-time can influence the mapping of space-time. So I don't know.
Thank you. And so, Abhi, you want to ask a question?
Yeah. So, I mean, I thought I would make a quick comment. This is basically for younger people. You know, many of the issues that are being discussed here, not all by any means, but many of the issues that are being discussed here were discussed, you know, in quantum gravity community for a very long time. And this is the point that Carlo was making as his statement of provocative statements. But in particular, there is a book which was the conference proceedings in which, you know, people like, you know, Bryce DeWitt and Jim Hartle and Mary Gelman and Carol Kukash and Chris Isham and all these people participated. And there's a whole section of this book which is devoted to the issue of time. And that section of the book actually discusses many of the problems that were discussed by both in the talks and the discussion sections. Again, I want to emphasize, not all, but many of those things. So I think just people in particular quantum information may not be aware of it. So I just pulled it up. The book is called Conceptual Problems in Quantum Gravity, and it is based on an Osgood Hill conference that we had. And it was it is edited by me and John Stacher. And that is from 1991, Berkhausen. So this was a small comment that it might be helpful to for people to look at these old discussions in which many of these issues were already clarified, but by no means all. Okay, and then, I mean, it seemed to me maybe you just asked a question about, you know, what viewpoint to take. It seems to me, and I want to understand if my understanding is correct. It seems to me that Lorenzo did say explicitly that, you know, in his framework, he's using these clocks, which are the moment, the Hamiltonian, just momentum, free, you know, is just a, free Hamiltonian. I mean, there's a free, just P naught, right? P clock. And therefore we got T, which is running continuously, and that won't be a realistic clock. And therefore for realistic clocks, one would have to do something like what Rodolfo was doing. Now, I think as Philip was saying that there are other dimensions to it. I mean, one need not have loss of unitarity, et cetera. But it seems to me that broadly, the question was answered, your question. So I just want to know if Lorenzo agrees and if maybe doesn't think it is answered.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree. Can I ask you something about the quantum gravity community instead? So it seems that people are arguing that there's a lower bound to the precision in which you can measure time due to the gravitational effects that happen when you put too much energy in your clock. But it seems that these would put a limit on the measurement of space-time regions, right? Because you can dilute the energy as much as you want, and then you don't have any lower bound to measurement of time, right?
So you're right. So the statement is that, I agree. So, but okay. then the statement is that it is really, your clock is spread out enormously.
Yes, exactly. If you spread out the energy, then you shouldn't have any fundamental bound on the...
Right. So one is talking there about clocks of finite size, and I mean, more precise statements do talk about, you know, if the clock has some finite size that is given to you, then what is the maximum energy you can put? So the more precise.
Thank you. There's a nice discussion in some papers from the mid-2000s by Steve Giddings, Don Merrill, actually mostly Steve Giddings, where they discuss how well you can localize using relational observables or relational clocks in space-time. So it's both in space and time. And so there, this discussion, with black hole formation and so on, actually, when you put too much energy into subregion to really localize well, is kind of nicely discussed. So maybe that's something you might want to check out.
Right. That paper had a conceptual issue, and that was corrected by Jerzy Lewandowski and one of his people in his group. So that might also be one to look up at this follow-up as well. They said something which is technically not quite right. And Lewandowski's paper was very, very nice. So, and it also has to do with reference systems and so on. So that would be good. I don't want to take that. We have limited time, and I'd like to go to, first of all, we have to talk about what Giddings said and why it was limited and how they corrected. Who can talk about it? Or I can send you the reference to the paper. That might be easier.
Thank you. Harvey?
You're muted.
Yeah.
We can't hear you.
Apologies. I have a very simple-minded question that I'd like to put to Philip concerning reference frames that are instantiated by physical objects, whether they're classical or quantum. If you think of the history of celestial mechanics, you think of the history of theories of the application of Newtonian mechanics to the planetary system, you can't take any one of the celestial bodies and define a reference frame with respect to them and expect the physics to be simple and expect, for example, with respect to these reference frames that you have the standard conservation principles, because they're all interacting amongst themselves. And the search for the real inertial frames in which these principles hold is very tricky, and it involves an enormous amount of iterative processes and measurements. Why is it not the same in quantum mechanics? Do the standard conservation principles hold when you define your reference frames with respect to quantum objects, even when they're relatively locally, they're well localized, and when one doesn't have, the sort of superposition effects that people have been discussing? What happens to the standard conservation principles? And by the way, this is very closely connected with Mehdi's, I think Mehdi's point very well taken, that in the Page Waters construction, one should allow for interaction between the two, between the system and the so-called clock system.
That's, I think, a little deeper question. So it depends on what sort of conservation laws we can actually formulate in the quantum reference frame scenarios that we're discussing. I mean, if you think about energy, for instance, then certainly that is in these clock models, it certainly is conserved. It's just by construction somehow, you have the energy of the clock and system.
But is it the same energy that you would get by introducing inertial frames?
So the discussion of inertial frames in some of these simple models is a little difficult. So we don't really have enough structure there to talk about a notion of inertial frames in these clock models. I mean, there is a way in which you can talk about inertial frames. So it depends on what sort of group you're discussing in your quantum reference frame context. So for instance, Flaminia and so on, they've considered inertial frames with respect to the Galilei group, and you can do it. And I think actually Flaminia has also recently discussed local inertia frames in space-time. And so I think, she would be probably better equipped to answer that question for her work. So regarding conservation laws that you're referring to within that work, I think probably Flaminia should answer that.
Thank you.
Okay, so in the work that Czaslaw presented that we did with Esteban and Czaslaw, so the first work that we did on quantum reference frames, which is just in the Galilean setting, which is different, by the way, to the other approach to quantum reference frames that Mehdi was talking about, and that also Rodolfo mentioned in his talk. So we, that was before our work. And so there we define this superposition of translations, and you can show also that in that context, you can have conserved quantities, and there is a way in which you can define these conserved quantities by mapping between two different quantum reference frames. So that's one thing you can do. And then in terms of the group of transformation, so these inertial quantum reference frame transformations do form a group. And we have shown that together with Angel Ballesteros and Giulio Gubitosi. So you can basically compose them. And if you start from a free particle Hamiltonian, you end up with a free particle Hamiltonian. And these transformations that map the free particle Hamiltonian to the free particle Hamiltonian are closed under a group structure. And yeah, so the and okay, and then in terms of inertial frames, Czaslaw mentioned that briefly at the end of his talk. We have defined the notion of a quantum local inertial frame, which is done pretty much in the same way as in the Galilean case, just that we are on a curved spacetime and in a superposition of curved spacetime, in a sense that Czaslaw defined in his talk, which is where we have two different classical configurations of the gravitational field that are macroscopically distinguishable and hence orthogonal, and then you can linearly superpose them. And in that way, in that case, you can just generalize the superposition, so the usual transformation to a local inertial frame, to this superposition of spacetimes, and basically find that when you look at the gravitational field at where this quantum system is located, so you go to the perspective of a quantum system that lives in the superposition of curved spacetimes, then at the origin of this quantum reference frame, then you have Minkowski metric, basically. But I think this is a bit different to what you were asking.
Well, it just seems I can understand why you're able to get conservation principles, but they won't be the same as the conservation principles you have in when you define your dynamics with respect to inertial frames. And that's really the point I'm making.
Yes, I think.
In fact, the connection will be quite complicated. Everything becomes much, much simpler when you use the inertial frames.
Yes, I think you're right in that they are different. Yes, yes.
Thank you.
So actually now we have to close the discussion because we have to set up the slides for the colloquium. But I would like to thank all our panelists once more for both the interesting talks and the contribution during the discussion session, and all of the participants and the people who asked questions and commented. And thanks a lot. We are enjoying this workshop very much.
Thank you.